Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Ever since 1975, when the North Vietnamese People's Army rolled to victory over South Vietnam, the country has been under the unified rule of a communist regime inspired by the atheistic principles of Marx and Lenin. Despite a constitution that grants citizens the freedom to worship, the Communist Party in control of the country exercises fairly strict control over religious institutions there. Nonetheless, religion continues to make its presence felt, with roughly half the population claiming at least nominal adherence to Buddhism, according to the U.S. State Department's Religious Freedom Report, and Catholicism, the next largest religion, constituting about 8% of the population. Despite its numerically small presence, the Catholic Church has played a visible role in the nation, with bishops often vocally supporting the cause of human rights. Some scholars have even speculated that as Vietnam goes through a gradual process of economic liberalization, that the Church might play a role in enhancing political openness. A recent podcast with Daniel Philpott highlighted some of the ways that religious groups, including the Catholic Church, has promoted democracy around the world. So today, I thought we'd take a closer look at the Vietnamese case and see if it has any similarities with other cases around the world, particularly Eastern Europe, which today's guest has studied as well. And that brings me to today's guest, Professor Lan Chu, an assistant professor in the Department of Diplomacy and World Affairs at Occidental College in Los Angeles, and previously a visiting fellow in the Department of Political Science at the University of Southern California. She is the author of numerous articles on religion in various academic journals such as Politics and Religion, the Journal of Vietnamese Studies, East European Politics and Society, and most recently, the journal Democratization. Lan, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, your name recently came to my attention, and given that I've been trying to engage in topics outside of the United States, I thought your research both in Vietnam and Eastern Europe would make for a great discussion, given that we don't hear much about religion or religious life in Vietnam. And then when I contacted you over email to set up this interview, you sent me back a note saying that we had previously had an interchange probably about 6 or 7 years ago. And I was wondering if you'd like to tell our audience about that exchange, because I think it has a great deal to say about how scholars conduct research and about how you in particular perform your scholarship.
Sure. I think it was 6 or 7 years ago when I was a graduate student and I still formulating my dissertation topic. Now, prior to that, I had originally written on the Catholic Church in Czechoslovakia, its role in the democratization process there. So, but as I was writing my dissertation, or as I wanted to write my dissertation, I wanted to go outside of Eastern Europe. So I was interested in Vietnam, but at the same time, I started to think, why wasn't anyone really paying attention to the Catholic Church after the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe? So that was really strange to me that everyone celebrated how it was such an important actor, but no one really paid attention to it afterwards or in any other country. So then I started to think about the best case in which the Catholic Church was supportive of the democratization movement, and that would be Poland. Then I thought about Vietnam, how no one, as you noted, really talked about it. But what about in the case in a completely different region, such as Cuba, in Latin America and the Caribbean, which would be Cuba? So what I wanted to do was really compare all three cases, but my graduate advisors thought that was just too broad, and they thought I should seek outside advice, and actually suggested that I contact you.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote me a really cool email, which basically said that, well, those countries are really different. They're in different regions, and it's funny how my committee actually mentioned you're really trying to compare apples and oranges, and what you had written to me was that even apples and oranges really could still be compared because they're all fruit, in terms of the year, there are seasonal differences, but nonetheless, we can still understand something when we compare very different things.
Yeah, that was comparing of apples and oranges. I hear that a lot, and it happens to be one of my pet peeves in academia, where we hear that a lot in methodological classes. Oh, you can't compare apples and oranges. I say, I do that all the time. I go to the grocery store, and if the price of oranges goes up 20 cents, I look at the apples and I say, well, they're a much better value. Or, you know, I'm feeling I have a cold coming on, so there's more vitamin C in oranges than there's apple. I compare them all the time. So if we can compare apples and oranges, why not compare other countries?
Exactly. And that's exactly what I've done. I took all three cases, and as a comparativist, or the method that I used was something called structured focus comparison, where I looked at three cases that had a single variable that was really common across all three cases. And in my studies, that would be the Catholic Church, because it considers itself a universal institution in the sense that it really conducts itself in terms of doctrine, institutional structure. It's the same in every country around the world. I mean, I was reading an article where, somewhere I had read that you can go into any Catholic church and regardless of the language, you know exactly what's going to happen next in terms of the mass service. And mm-hmm. that's how it considers itself a universal institution. So when I'm comparing the cases, when you're looking at these apples and oranges, what you see is it takes into account the negative checks on prior explanations. So when I looked at the three cases, I realized that people really sort of overestimated what the Polish church had done. Samuel Huntington had recognized that it was one of the five leading variables that led to democratization, and people started to really compare all other cases to Poland and said, well, why couldn't you be more like the Polish church? Or that was the only case where it was really successful. But what you see is that when you compare all three cases is that all the churches across around the world in similar situations are more or less doing the same thing. So that what I had argued in my dissertation is that we really overestimated that case, and we really need to pay attention to these other cases so we can understand really the full potentials of a single variable.
Okay, I that is an interesting comparison that you do, and I like those kind of studies where you see somebody stretching the bounds of cross-regional comparisons, and I do think we can learn quite a bit about it. And the fact that you've studied Poland in contrast with Vietnam and Cuba as well, three different spots around the world, I think really is going to highlight what you did learn. You get to see different things that you might not have seen if you were just looking at Vietnam. I mean, is that your experience there?
Absolutely. If we look at the Polish case, for example, you have a high level of religiosity. I'd say at the time of communism, it was about 98% to 99% of the population identifying themselves as being Catholics. Of that 98% or 99%, I'd say again, probably a high 90s, there was a high level of religiosity. You compare that to Vietnam and you would think, well, it's a minority religion. It can't play as much of a role. But when you look at the numbers, again, it's a minority religion at 8%, but actually 95% of that 8% are extremely religious, and they go to mass, they go to service every week. So what you see is that it's perhaps a much stronger institution than we think it is. And when you look at the way in which the Vietnamese state has really focused on the Catholic Church, you start to wonder, it must be a lot stronger than we think it is, because why would a government pay so much attention to an institution that's not supposed to be as strong?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead, since we're talking about Vietnam and the strength of the church there, too. And again, you're right to highlight that 8% can oftentimes be deceiving, in the fact that 95% of those 8% are very strong believers. You're talking about 7% then of the population that really has this fervent religion. And right. That 7% of the population can make a big, huge difference here. But it's interesting, I think, for me and some of our other listeners, that when you think about Vietnam, you often don't think about Catholicism. I mean, growing up in the latter half of the Vietnam War for myself, and having studied in school, I never really associated Catholicism with Vietnam. Yet I then realized that Indochina was really a French colony, so it shouldn't have come as a surprise to me. It's just not talked about that much. And then as I did my graduate studies, I did find out that the Catholic Church did play a very significant role in Vietnam's history. So for the benefit of our listeners, could you give us a bit of background on Catholicism's arrival in the region and what social and political role it played in, let's say, the colonial period or the post or the pre-World War II period?
Sure. Catholicism was actually brought to Vietnam by the Portuguese in the 16th century, but it wasn't very successful. It wasn't until the 17th century with the French Jesuits and Alexander de Rhodes who actually came to Vietnam, and it was much more successful then. And actually, he was really credited with the current Vietnamese alphabet that we see. So what you when you compare the languages and the writing of, let's say, of the Chinese and the Vietnamese, with the Vietnamese, it's actually the Roman alphabet with diacritics, and that's really credited to the Catholic missionaries. But originally, it was seen as a colonial religion. Catholics were seen as foreigners. But people who did join the faith were really seeking additional privileges. They were looking to sort of better themselves. And what the French had done was they really divided the population, or at least, I'm sorry, the French Catholics had done was they really divided the population by focusing on converting the elites. So what you established was this real strong class divide between the peasants and the elites. So what you saw was is that local priests, there were the establishment of local priests, but you also had a lot of European bishops that represented the faith. So the peasants saw Catholicism as mainly just another foreigner coming in and trying to take over the country. But what is interesting, though, is by 1902, the French are the ones who really came in and created Hanoi University. They really wanted to educate the people, to really discipline them towards understanding French history and respecting the French. And it's out of that university is where Ho Chi Minh actually learned about the past, and people started to really question on what their rights were in the country. So there is that strong connection between the French and the Catholics, but at the same time, it sort of advanced or slowly modernized Vietnam by providing the outlets for education.
You mentioned Ho Chi Minh, and he becomes one of the primary players in rising up against French colonialism, a very nationalistic leader.
Right.
The irony of this, and this is something that you see in other countries as well. You see it in China and a few other places where there's the struggle against colonialism, but many of the colonial or the anti-colonial leaders are the ones who have been trained in Western universities.
Yes.
So I've always found that to be an interesting observation. We see that here in Vietnam as well. I didn't know that Ho Chi Minh was trained in the Hanoi University, which in turn was a Jesuit university.
Right.
Okay. So you kind of mentioned it's an elite religious, especially in the 17th and 18th century.
Right.
But with the creation of Hanoi University, and again, early 1900s, it's not like everybody's going to college as here in the United States,
right,
where you get a majority of the population. So it still must be a relatively elite type,
yes,
of religion. Is there any move to make it more, bring it down to the masses? Or specifically, I'm interested in the leadership of the church there. Was there any effort to indigenize the Catholicism by bringing in local Vietnamese into the clergy or even to the bishoprics?
No, that did not actively occur until the 1960s, which was when the church had the Second Vatican Council and the meeting in which there was a campaign of inculturation where Catholicism for each country, especially in Asia, would actually be focused more on the national history and the culture. So that was the first time where local songs, saints that would come directly from Vietnam or from a particular country, local customs would actually be sort of integrated into the faith. Now, prior to the 1960s and getting back to the colonial period that you're speaking of, people who were interested in the Catholic Church or Catholicism really entered in, I believe, really converted or entered in so that they can really just advance themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the time, again, prior to Vatican II, is that it really separated itself in the sense of Catholicism outside of Europe, they really just spoke to one another in Latin. They didn't even speak Vietnamese or French to one another because that was the only way that they could communicate. Again, only till the 1960s was when the Bible was translated into Vietnamese. But it was really difficult to really indigenize the religion.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine that's going to play an important role, too, in the anti-colonial movement and how the church is perceived by a number of people. Even before we get to that, Vietnam has really experienced a century of very violent conflict in the 20th century. And this is not only the Vietnam War that we think about here in the United States, but it even goes back further. And I'm thinking about the Japanese invasion during World War II. How did that play out? And where did the Catholic Church fit into this aspect of Vietnamese history?
This is where it's interesting is that the Catholics and the Catholic Church actually started to unite more with the people in the sense that it started to support the Viet Minh, it started to support the idea of the campaign of self-determination because of all of the atrocities that were occurring. Now, following the Japanese arrival and then the removal and then the return of the French, that continued the Catholic support of the Viet Minh, because at the time, Ho Chi Minh, and even today, Catholics recognize he really was a nationalist. And it wasn't until probably in 1949 when he started to move away, or the Catholic Church started to be concerned with the Viet Minh and its movement towards real communist ideology. And 1949 represents the time in which Mao was really victorious in China and where the Chinese actually started to persecute the Catholic Church there. By the 1960s, what had happened was that you had the Sino-Soviet split, and then that's when Vietnam moved closer to Soviet ideology and pure communism. So there was the concern there that perhaps similar to China, or similar to the Soviet Union, that the Catholic Church would start to become really persecuted. It was at that point it became staunchly anti-communist. I mean, in the 1960s, there was a pastoral letter that the Catholic Church had issued saying that if you would simply be excommunicated, there's absolutely no way one could be a Catholic and a communist.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of that, I mean, I'm thinking back again to the Japanese incursion. Did the Catholic Church, you know, join in, and I guess France, too, being part of the Allies, but they're occupied in Europe. Was there any effort by the Catholics to really resist this the Japanese invasion and really stamp itself as a nationalist type of movement? Did that have any impact on how it viewed itself in the coming decades?
Yeah, I think at that point it did consider itself more nationalist, but at the same time, because it was receiving so much support from the French, I think it is still trying to find a place for itself. I think when you look at the Catholic hierarchy or you speak to anyone in the hierarchy today, there's really a lot of confusion they're trying to really grapple with the history of what had happened in the past and the church's relationship with foreigners. And what they really like to do is not talk about it. So what they try to say, the past is past, and what we'd like to do is just try to be on this campaign of national reconciliation. I mean, it would say that it was, yes, it supported any movement against the Japanese, but at the same time, I don't think it was prepared to turn its back on the French at that time. It's only when the French started to come back in because of its experience of fighting against the Japanese, it started to think, perhaps we should start this movement of self-determination and join in with fellow non-Catholics with this movement.
Now, you had mentioned that the church really hadn't been indigenizing itself very effectively. So during this period of nationalist uprising, and this would have been in the late 1940s, early 1950s, there were still a number of French priests.
Yeah.
And so was there any concern for, you know, the French priests are saying, whoa, the writing's on the wall here. It looks like this place is going to go nationalist. I'm part of the French colonial system. I better pack up and leave. Or were there actually French priests and bishops joining in on the Vietnamese side of this?
I wouldn't think so. I think what it was really just trying to do was establish its place within whatever what events were going to happen next. Now, what is interesting is that in 1958, after the Japanese had left and the French tried to return, because again, the Catholic Church was still trying to sort of entrench itself, 1958, in the North especially, which is where Catholicism was stronger, that's where all of the foreign missionaries, and that's when the Vatican missionary or the Vatican delegation was completely expelled. So that what you had left was you didn't have any of the French anymore, and you just had the very few remaining Catholics or priests, the Catholic priests, who were actually Vietnamese. So it was really difficult to see what was going to happen next. And I think if you look back, they were perhaps trying to play their cards very carefully as to what would happen next.
Mm-hmm. And so this brings us up to the division of Vietnam, and I think that occurs in the 1954 Geneva Accords, where Vietnam is split into North Vietnam and South Vietnam, right around the 17th parallel. Now, you had mentioned that the Catholic activity in the past had really been focused in the northern part of the country, and yet that is the territory that is claimed to the nationalists, claimed to the Viet Minh, the communists. What happens after 1954?
Basically, in 1954, I think you had just mentioned perhaps Catholics in the north will see the writing on the wall. When they see that communism is starting to take over in the north, basically you have a huge exodus from north to south, about 900,000 people. 700,000 of those are actually Catholics. And the campaign that they had was that they are killing the Virgin Mary, they will kill Catholics, so you had a very quick movement from north to south. Once that movement from north to south happened, it's what I argued, there was an establishment of a split personality between the Catholic Church and Vietnam. What you see really is the development of two churches, one that is much slower than the other in terms of the outside world, and the slower one being in the north.
Yeah, before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about what you mentioned, that there was the killing of the Virgin Mary. What was there anything going on in North Vietnam at this time that gave these Catholics reason to be concerned and basically take off? Was Ho Chi Minh engaging in some kind of policy of Catholic eradication or burning churches, or what was going on?
I don't think it was an official policy from Ho Chi Minh to say that we will not work with the Catholic Church, because he did have their support initially. But I think over time, as he was trying to establish stronger relations with the communist community internationally, that he had to follow the very distinct personality of communism, which is atheism. So it was that point, yes, there were purges across the country. There were re-education camps. As I had mentioned before, there was the expelling of the foreign missionaries as well as the Vatican. So then people really started to move quickly. But I wouldn't say initially and immediately there was the full campaign against Catholics. Once they moved downwards, I think what had happened at that point was that the Southern Church started to make it very clear that we were not going to be like the Northern Church. In 1955, that's when basically the Vietnamese state started the creation of something called the Liaison Committee of Patriotic and Peace-Loving Catholics, which people refer to as the Patriotic Priest Association, which is a way of co-opting the Catholic Church into the state.
And this was in North Vietnam.
In North Vietnam.
And so, and I have to admit, I love whenever communists give names to things like that, they're always great. I mean, I love the posters that they produce, whether it's in Cuba or North Korea or whatever. This
right.
is the Liaison of Committee of Patriotic and Peace-Loving Catholics. And that's a really, is it shorter in Vietnamese, or is it that long too?
It's pretty long.
I know. It does not roll off the tongue very easily. So basically what you have is Ho Chi Minh creating a parallel church.
There was an attempt to do it.
Okay.
And the interesting thing, again, if you compare the Catholic Church in Vietnam with China, it wasn't very successful. It's present today in another form, but Catholic priests see it as a way of just sort of moving their agenda along more quickly. So, for example, if you wanted to have a permit to have some sort of gathering, if you are a patriotic priest, you're more likely to get the permit a little bit quicker. So that's what people have tended to do. But it's interesting, when I interviewed a bishop in North Vietnam, and I said, to my understanding, reviewing the history and the way the church is today, is that I really do see two churches. Could you explain that a little bit more? And he looked at me wild-eyed and said, are absolutely not two churches. We are a single church. There is the Committee for Patriotic Priests, but they're still under our authority. And it was just unheard of that there could possibly be any division within the church. So it's interesting that Catholics in Vietnam, at least the Catholic hierarchy, they really take pride that they're simply just not China. And that's a direct quote, that we're not like them. We don't have a patriotic church or what's considered a parallel church.
Well, what made you think that you were seeing two different types of churches? What prompted that question to the bishop?
When interviewing hierarchy between the North and the South, you see completely different attitudes, and you see a lot of internal disagreement. So, for example, in the North, remains completely anti-communist, refuses to speak with the government. If the state would like to have some sort of conference, they're very cautious. They really tell their seminarians, you have to be cautious of the church. They remind the seminarians of the history that they have gone through. Whereas in the South, they're much more liberal. They would say, sure, you know, we're in a time where there's political liberalization. We have much more rights now. We can speak with the government. We can work together. And they said, we're just not as stubborn as those Northerners. Now, going back to the North, I said, well, you know, the Southerners think you're stubborn. And they said, we have to be stubborn, because how do you think Catholicism survived in Vietnam? It's because we were stubborn that we are still able to be a Catholic church today. So that's what you get between the two. And I think the state really recognizes those internal differences as well.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you mentioned in your work is that a part of this Committee of Patriotic and Peace-Loving Catholics was that the North Korean government got a great deal of say over who would become a priest, who would become a bishop, how many priests would be accepted into seminary and would be ordained in any given year. That must have had an effect on the priesthood there. And what you're saying, I mean, the fact that the Catholic bishops and priests were pretty stubborn to survive that period of time where they were under heavy repression, I'm trying to square these things, I guess, is the best way to say it, is if the North Vietnamese government is picking the priests and the bishops, why wouldn't we assume that the bishops and the priests are much more friendly to the government?
Well, in terms of the Vietnamese government, when they're saying we would like to have all authority over the appointment of bishops or the number of priests that can basically go into seminary or even travel, because the way to advance yourself in the seminary or to advance towards the priesthood is to have some sort of international travel and to eventually go to the Vatican and continue your studies there. What the Catholic Church has done, especially in the North, was, well, even more so in the South, but more so in the North, is you won't appoint our bishops, then guess what? We'll just pass on having a bishop. You won't allow our seminarians to travel, we'll leave basically churches empty with a lower number of priests that are allowed to give service, because they, with the high level of religiosity, Catholics will travel far and wide to a specific location in order to celebrate Mass. So they're willing to do that, to basically make certain sacrifices in order to make their point that you, meaning the state, do not have the final authority over the church, because their understanding is, when it comes to the Vatican, it's the final authority. And one bishop has actually even told me, we consider ourselves the most obedient son or daughter of the Catholic Church. And that's why they turn towards the Vatican and are willing to ignore, basically, the state. Now, the new sort of strategy that they've taken is that they say, we recognize the game that the state is playing, that they, more or less, to save face, which is very important in Asian cultures, is that in order not to disrespect the state, we will basically put forth three names to become bishop. Now, the state can finally say, well, out of those three names, we'll pick one person. And so the state can basically make the announcement, we have appointed the bishop. Now, the Catholic Church will then turn to their parishioners and say, it was our understanding that any one of those three would be perfectly fine in that position. So in actuality, we have the final say. So you have this game that's being played between the church and the state in terms of who really controls everything.
Yeah, that's really interesting how that plays out, because it reminds me a great deal about colonial Latin America, when the king always wanted to have a say on who the bishops would be. And then later on, the national governments in the early 1800s, they would sit and say, okay, fine, we'll let you choose, but there's a pretty small pool of candidates. Right. If you're going to be a bishop, you got to know the Bible thing, right? You can't get away with just being some schlub off the street or some party hack. And so, yeah, they do present, and it's the same thing in Latin America. You presented three names. All of those names were pretty acceptable. But again, it seems like this agreement, the state can make one claim saying, yeah, we got to pick who was the bishop. On the other hand, the Catholic Church says, yes, but we had a very important say and who that pool would actually be. And I think this gets to your research and the comparative nature of this. One of the things that I like about it is that you can see also this at play in Poland. You can see this at play in Cuba. And then I think in comparison with the Russian Orthodox Church, when the priest or the bishops were appointed in the Russian Orthodox Church, they were largely toadies of the state.
Right.
But the Russian Orthodox Church never really had that external pope or patriarch to guide to. And the fact that the Catholic Church is an international institution, I think, gave the Catholic Church a little bit more bargaining power when it came to the selection of the bishops and then on down line to the priests.
Right. Okay. It's interesting, though, too. In 2003, it was the last time when Archbishop Ming Mun was basically elevated to be cardinal, and that was a pure decision by the Vietnamese Catholic Bishops Conference and the cardinal, and that was the first time where the state was not consulted. So when I was actually in Vietnam at the time, there was a huge uproar. How dare he be elevated? He wasn't chosen. And the church officials, they just looked at each other. They were basically joking with one another, said, yeah, you know, we didn't consult them, but we really needed to make a statement that at the end of the day, it's really the Vatican as well as the Vietnamese Catholic Bishops Conference that really decides. Mm-hmm. So what Cardinal Mun had to do was to go in front of to the Committee of Patriotic Priests and basically get censured by the state. But that was it. And they said it's really just a slap on the wrist and we go back to business as usual. But again, mm-hmm. it was our choice. So that was the last time, and that was one of the examples where they really just didn't pay attention to the state.
Now,
in retaliation for that, what the state really has done then was to shift its focus away from the hierarchy in the north and move it towards the south. And so what it does is it tries to have more discussion with bishops and cardinals and priests in the south, because they believe they're much more liberal and they try to ignore the north. And that's not really working out so well for them, because again, when you think of the hierarchy or the institution of the church, the central focus still comes out of Hanoi.
Yeah. And that is interesting how, again, you're comparing this, the Northern Church and the Southern Church. They still claim to be one church, but there's a different a sense or feeling to this. And in your research, you bring to bear something that occurs in the 1960s. And again, this is when the country is still divided.
Yes.
That you have, you know, the northern half run by the Viet Minh, and then the southern half, which is run by Diem, and who's a Catholic. And so that you have two different environments there. And then you have the Second Vatican Council occur at this time. And since we've been talking about the Vatican, tell us a little bit about how North Vietnam responded to the Second Vatican Council and how South Vietnam did back in the 60s.
At the time, the church had decided to sort of modernize itself, or at least adapt itself to how the world was changing. So with the idea of decolonization occurring around the world, it really wanted to make itself available to local customs and local traditions and make the religion much more appealing to communities around the world. When it came to Vietnam, the North Vietnamese Catholic Church was really under great persecution and oppression. They were not allowed to leave the country, whereas in the South, bishops were allowed to go to the Second Vatican Council and they began to understand that you should actually focus much more on national reconciliation. You should focus more on your national identity as well as your local customs. So there was this huge divide between reconciling itself with its political situation. Now in the South, they were prepared to do that, to have much more open dialogue eventually, mm-hmm. after 1960 1975 with the communists. Now, in the North, however, it was completely different. Again, they were closed off. They didn't know that Vatican II was even occurring. And it wasn't until basically in 1968 or so is that with this sort of Khrushchev secret speech and allowing communists to go their own way, but also with Pope Paul VI, who basically decided we'll have a non-confrontational attitude with any political system. All we want simply is to develop the religion. So then the North Vietnamese had decided at the time, hey, look at that. Now they're basically non-confrontational towards us. Perhaps our North Vietnamese bishops can learn from that. And only then, in 1975, did they actually were allowed to go to the Vatican. So that is basically about six to seven years after the Southern Church had already learned at that point that, of course, we're going to be much more open and have a dialogue. So you have things that are occurring much more slowly in the North than in the South.
Yeah, that's one of the great ironies that in reading through your work that I found here was that the North Vietnamese should have been the ones sending their bishops to the Vatican Council too, saying, right, hey, guys, listen, they're talking about conciliation. Let's be friends here. And it should have been the South, on the other hand, right, that said, whoa, let's keep our bishops away from that, yeah, because they're going to start changing their attitudes toward our regime down here.
Right. Yeah. But now it's just again, the South is considered much more open. And again, I think that contributes to that split personality. You can talk about Vatican II in the North. They understand it. But then they balance the conversation with, but you don't understand what we went through, and it's because of us, and because of the attitude that we take, we simply cannot trust communists in any form. In the South, they say, sure, you can trust them to a certain extent. It's hard to get things done around here because our major concern is helping the Vietnamese people with the social welfare programs. So if we have to, once in a while, meet with a communist official, we'll do it. In the North, they simply say, you shake hands with the communists, they'll basically take your entire body and it's done. Yeah. So it's a very different attitude.
Yeah. At the beginning of this podcast, we talked about the diaspora of Catholics that came from the North to the South. Now, this, again, is after the 1954 Geneva Accords. So you still haven't gotten quite up to Vatican Council II yet. But how have the Catholics from the North who flood down to the South, how were they received in the South, both prior to Vatican Council II and then after? Do they eventually assimilate down to South Vietnamese culture and everybody embraces them, welcome our brethren from the North, or what's going on?
There was because Catholicism was much more accepted because, as you noted, Diem was a Catholic, his brother was an archbishop, so there was a welcoming of Catholics down south. When you get the diaspora from going to the United States, however, that you have a completely different political animal. You have basically a return to a northern anti-communist mentality. So you can actually compare the Vietnamese diaspora in the United States here. You can basically say that they have the mentality of pre-1975 communism, mm-hmm, where you have completely anti-communist. They still believe that you cannot trust them. Here in the United States, they still promote flying the Vietnamese flag of the South. And again, what is interesting, as I had mentioned before, Cardinal Munn had actually, when he was in Australia at a certain point, he saw the older flag being flown, and he said, really, we shouldn't do that because we really need to accept our current situation. We should reconcile with our brothers and sisters in Vietnam, whether they're communist or not. And he was basically sort of ostracized, where you really don't hear from him anymore, because the diaspora community, not only in the United States but around the world, the Vietnamese Catholics basically are still in the very anti-communist mode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I'm glad you brought that up. We're talking here about the diaspora away from Vietnam, you know, the Vietnamese boat people period of the late 1970s coming to the United States, and as you mentioned, also Australia and a few other places. So, the hardliners, the hardline anti-communist attitude really kind of flourishes in there. What's happening in Vietnam, though, at the time after 1975? How are Catholics adapting to this new regime here?
Well, they're basically seeing it more as, it's a way that we can live our faith freely. You have that huge movement from north to south, and I think they get assimilated pretty quickly. They understand all of the opportunities, again, and privileges that are available to them. Because at the time, under the Diem regime, because he is Catholic, he was very selective. People have argued, at least in Vietnam, he's very selective with his Catholicism in the sense that he chose people who were Catholic to be, given specific privileges. He was extremely corrupt at the time. You had a lot of bishops and priests who were in the church who actually went to him and said, this is not how if you're understanding Second Vatican Council, you're supposed to be much more open to everyone. But he decided to live in a really, I guess, pre-Vatican II way of thinking, well, if I am Catholic, I'm a direct sort of agent of God, so I can basically decide who and what gets what and what can basically happen. So you had a bit of a divide. I wouldn't say it was a big divide, but you still had a bit of divide between Diem as a Catholic as well as the Catholic Church. But throughout the South, you still had the Buddhists who were basically saying, we have this Catholic regime that is extremely corrupt. There was a divide between the Catholic and the Buddhist community, but at the same time, we shouldn't neglect the fact that there were also Catholics who were still protesting against the Diem regime and how he was treating others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you bring that up very well too in your research. Let's focus on the post 75 era now, after the country is unified under the communist regime. One of the interesting things that occurs historically that goes on here is after 1975, 1976, you have the communist regime, and this is a period in world history where you're starting to see détente within the international arena, that the West and the communist world are basically trying to cool things off a little bit. And eventually the communist world gives way in 1989, the collapse of East Europe and the Berlin Wall, the 1991, the Soviet Union collapse. So basically, the Vietnamese regime that is unified after 1975 only has about a decade and a half to live in the communist world. But after 1989, this becomes discredited. So what is happening in Vietnam during this period, just politically, before we even get to talking about the church? What happens? How does the Vietnamese regime react to the collapse of the Berlin Wall?
They see it as a failure of ideology, really. So basically all of the remaining communist countries, if you look at statements by Castro, even in China, when they look at the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union, they just said that there was just no, they weren't faithful to the communist ideology as they should have been. So what these communists across the world are really trying to return to is trying to save the ideology. But if you pair that at the same time, however, is with the collapse of the Soviet Union, what you're also having is this huge sort of gap or deficit in terms of financial support. So what you get in the case of the Vietnamese communists is they're trying to do everything they can to assert the ideology that it is still basically valid, but at the same time, they're trying to be very careful of not having this widespread political unrest or social uprisings. And it's interesting, it's at that time where they start to think, where really can we start to reconcile with the agents within Vietnam who can basically help our cause? Now, one of the first institutions they look at is basically the Catholic Church, which is, again, interesting. You're dealing with a minority religion. Why are you so interested in the Catholic Church? Because what they started to understand was it played some sort of role in Eastern Europe. So we really should pay attention to it here. So by 1986, you have the period of Glasnost in the Soviet Union. That's really the time when the Vietnamese started their own Saigon Spring and decided, okay, let's liberalize a little bit and say, if people have their grievances, let them critical, we'll address them. Unlike Tiananmen Square, where the students had basically gone out and protested under the government and were basically repressed, what the Vietnamese had done was when the students protested, they actually had a conversation with them and said, well, perhaps there are some reforms that we need to take. So what the Vietnamese were actually doing was learning from everyone else's mistake. So as communism was basically crumbling and still at the same time trying to strengthen itself in these other areas, the Vietnamese were really trying to look at what everyone else was doing and not have the same mistakes. So in that Saigon Spring in 86, you had the students criticizing. The Catholic Church was actually growing. By 1988, it was the first time where the Catholic Church canonized in one shot, which is unheard of before, 117 Vietnamese saints. And they all celebrated on one single day in November. So the state at that time started to get a little concerned that the church was getting ahead of itself. So what it done was it returned back to its ways of saying, well, this is a foreign institution. The saints that they're canonizing are actually foreign agents. But that's when the Catholic Church, again, following what Poland had done, was really go back to keep the communists apart, which is their identity and their nationalism, and said, well, this is something that's really raising Vietnam's national identity. How can you, the Vietnamese communists, be something that's against making the international community aware of what Vietnam's really all about? So that sort of was a shot in the, you know, a shot towards the Vietnamese communists that we're actually better nationalists than you are, and perhaps you should probably tone down the critique that you have against us, which is the Catholic Church.
Yeah, that's a really interesting part of your thesis, that the Catholic Church starts to use the language of the Vietnamese regime in such a way as to strengthen themselves. Explain that a little bit more.
So what it does, the language of the regime really is, if you go back to it, it has to do with nationalism and national identity, self-determination. And so what the church had done was, again, because of Vatican II, because Vatican II had requested that churches really focus on the local customs, basically they turned back to the heart of what it means to be Vietnamese. So for the Catholic Church, you could be Catholic, but you're also Vietnamese as well. And the most important thing for you to do is basically look out for your fellow brothers and sisters. So it basically came to terms, it being the Catholic Church, came to terms that we will work with any government that will look out for the social welfare of our people. And if it happens to be communist, and if those communists are using that ideology of workers' rights, then that's where we're really going to that will be the basis of our dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And what is demographically happening with the Catholic Church now? Because of this nationalist dialogue and connecting with the regime and on their terms and the rhetoric saying, yes, we are also in support of the workers, et cetera, are they starting to pick up more adherence? Is there a growth in Catholicism in the 1980s and 90s?
Actually, there is. There was a growth. I don't have those figures mm-hmm. because they're really not documented as well. But right. Later on, between 1996 and 2001, there was an increase of 14%. And then between 2001 and 2005, there was another increase of 12%. So you do have this growing trend of, well, the Catholic Church has really made it clear it is not a foreign institution. It is actually one of the major institutions within Vietnam that provides most of the social welfare programs, because the government simply cannot provide everywhere. So what the government has actually done was turn to the church and say, well, could you have these hospices or hospitals or orphanages that you can run for us? And it's, I think, I forget the year, but it has actually asked help internationally of the Catholic community, where Catholic Relief Services was brought in to help with the education.
Mm-hmm. And that's, in many ways, that's an interesting or smart strategy that the regime is actually pursuing here. Because again, after the Berlin Wall collapses, after the Soviet Union collapses, you lose a lot of the subsidized support. I mean, Cuba faces the exact same thing. And the communist ideology of, well, we're going to be able to provide for everybody, that's falling a little bit short. Right. So, yeah, let's go ahead and look for these other entities in civil society that can help us out here. So one would just imagine there's going to be this thawing of relations. They can work in a coordinated fashion. And as you mentioned, this is the Catholic bishops here are seeing this as a great opportunity to really reach out to civil society,
right.
But not appear confrontational with the regime.
Right.
No, that's pretty interesting there. Now, I know that Vietnam has gone through some economic liberalization over the past two decades. And in many ways, as you mentioned before, Vietnam regime has had the ability to actually learn from the mistakes of those who went before them. Has there been any movement toward political openness?
In Vietnam, yes. What they did was they opened up a lot of they've opened the elections at different levels. So you have more candidates for the National Assembly. The biggest controversy that has just happened in Vietnam was that Catholic priests were actually running for office, which has created this huge controversy within the Catholic Church. But I think that is really a way. Again, it's a strategy again of the Communist Party in Vietnam, which I believe is extremely clever, because what you had was prior to this, in 2008, what you had was the state had started to bulldoze a lot of the former church property that the church actually felt it was their right to receive back, and they felt very sacred. The church started to bulldoze a lot of the property, which caused a lot of demonstrations. There was actually a massive demonstration, I believe, in October of 2008, which is actually the largest demonstration that had occurred since communism had taken over. So that was a sign to the state that perhaps there is this level of strength that is still occurring in the Catholic Church. So what it does is every time the state has an attitude of openness towards the church, you also have to always watch out for that rollback that also occurs. And that happens a lot in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. In terms of that, I mean, as you mentioned, the Catholic Church is growing numerically. It's reaching out more to civil society in the past several years. Now, as you mentioned, there's even some Catholic priests that might be running for political office. Wow.
That was actually encouraged by the state.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, that's interesting to see all this happening. To what extent do you think the Catholic Church is going to become a partner in democratizing Vietnam? And I guess this also hinges upon your prognosis of whether or not Vietnam is primed for a democratization period in the near future.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it full democratization. If you're looking for full regime change or a full collapse the way you saw in Eastern Europe, I don't think that will happen. That's why in my work, I emphasize a lot about a lot on political liberalization, which is really making effective those rights that would protect citizens from arbitrary or illegal acts by the state. And that's really what the Catholic Church is focusing on. Because when I had talked about the bulldozing of church property, what the church was really putting forth there was not this is an anti-religious thing. It was more of a constitutional or an issue that really hinged on rights. It was their right to receive back this church property, something that the state had promised, but now it basically had reneged on those rights. And that's what they were really arguing on. And it was at that point when the Catholic Church started to talk more about human rights and their human dignity. And it's on those values that the church really is focused on. It is not looking, and that's when you go back to the Polish case, it wasn't looking for full democratization, because if you review all of the works, all of the Polish works, they basically said, we basically tried to live a better life. We weren't looking or even expecting full regime change. And I think that's what the Catholic Church in Vietnam is doing as well, is that they're not looking for this huge collapse to occur. They're just looking to really become more democratic the way the communists have actually promised, because communists do see themselves as much more democratic than liberal Democrats.
Yeah, and that is, again, you know, part of their general strategy is not to rock the boat too much, but just take small steps toward democratization. Right. And these things we often don't think about. When we think about democratization, we often think about elections and political parties competing with one another. But the things that we're talking about here are just basic human rights, basic property rights that once you start establishing those, you know, somewhere down the line, you might move in more or greater political openness as people become more confident with their ability to act in civil society. Let me ask you this with the time that we have left here. You've done some work recently thinking about the Cuban church. Are there any lessons that can be taken away from the Vietnamese case that could be transferred over to Cuba? Or in what regard do you think there are some similarities going on here?
There are actually a lot of similarities between the two, because the Cuban church was shut out of the Second Vatican Council as well. It wasn't, because of the 1959 revolution, they weren't able to send their bishops. The Cuban church was extremely weakened once Castro had come to power, because the majority of the hierarchy was of Spanish origin. So to basically establish now what is Cuban communism and to rid the state of any foreign influences, it basically, again, just sent out anyone who was of Spanish origin. That left a very weak church. By the time of the later 1970s, with the Latin American Bishops' Conference and the whole movement towards liberation theology, that's when Castro really decided, oh, so the Catholic Church really isn't anti-communist, it just has these new agendas. So when you looked at Vatican Council, inculturation was very important to Asia, but the liberation aspect was very important to the Latin American churches, and that's what they really moved on. So in the Cuban case, what you see is, again, liberation, but much more focused on reconciliation with the identity of the people and of being Cuban, and that's what the Cuban church has done a lot. And similarly, the church in Vietnam, they want to establish an environment of dialogue. They do want to, at the same time, maintain this critical distance as well, that there are specific rights that we are all accorded. And when Castro had actually greeted Pope John Paul II when he arrived in 1998, he had basically told the Pope, well, we're the only country that really respects human rights more than any other country in the Western Hemisphere. So that was saying a lot, and that's exactly with those words throughout the entire time that the Pope was there, from the Pope himself down to the Cuban bishops, down to the priests, they all started talking about what it really means to have human rights. And it was a challenge to the regime that you've said it, now you basically need to deliver.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And we're going to see how things play out there, and as Castro eventually passes from the scene. And you know, the same thing, too, in terms of Vietnam, that we're seeing generational shifts in the leadership there. So I guess my last question to you, in terms of Vietnam and in terms of Cuba, what's your prognosis? Are you fairly optimistic about the way that things are moving and that the Catholic Church will be able to flourish in these new environments? What's your take?
I think it is. I think it is flourishing, and there's already evidence of that. I think that a papal visit will eventually come to Vietnam. Now, it's interesting, we talked a lot about Vietnam, but to understand the development of the Catholic Church in Vietnam, you really have to look to China as well, because the only way that the Catholic Church in Vietnam moves forward is if anything happens in China first. So when the cardinal interviewed in Vietnam and said, well, when will come to Vietnam, the first thing he said, well, China first. So to understand how, or to have a better sense of how well or how far the Vietnamese Catholic Church will advance, you have to look at the church in China first. And it's interesting, again, when I had mentioned before, there are moments of liberalization and then rollback. The Vietnamese state really uses the establishing or the meetings with the Vatican as one of its tactics. So when it's ready to be much more open, it contacts the Vatican. They have all of these meetings. And then when that occurs, when they've established themselves, people trust the state a little bit more, that's when they close the meetings and say, well, we're not ready to have any sort of relations. And at one point, when you had mentioned earlier, you liked the way how communists have these really funny names for organizations, when one of the officials basically asked, well, when is the Pope coming to Vietnam? That Vietnamese official basically said, well, our airport isn't prepared to greet him yet. Mm. And that was basically his only response, that we just can't do it. So the Vietnamese church is waiting to see what is happening in China. Now, in Cuba, they're still working on dialogue. I think they're much more concerned with a post-Castro, when I say Castro, I mean Raul as well, in terms of what will happen next, because their concern really is the relationship with the United States. You have the diaspora community in Florida. So they're much more concerned with keeping the Cuban people together and really focusing on solidarity. I think for both countries, it's really maintaining focus on what is happening within the country and not necessarily what others are thinking of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are events that we're going to have to keep a watch on. We'll be watching Vietnam closely over the next few years, as well as Cuba, as the Castros get up there in age and maybe pass from the scene. So we will be sure to keep in touch with you. So in case there are other developments, we'll have you back on the show. How's that sound?
Great. Thank you so much.
Yes, I want to thank you again for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.